This is my child and this is my husband. Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK. And the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As-Saadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Saadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
As سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt, in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way, or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
اگر یه زندانی هم آزاد شد دیگه از حواس زندان نکنه مثلا.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری، حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن، حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. خاکم و سرزمین من همیشه جاودانه شد خاکم و رای من قدم قدم غیرت شور غزل غزل آی بلون از ابتدا تا انتها مردمی از جنس غرور اگر
اتفاق چیزی
See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
شما در این قرن معجزه کردید. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a particularly warm welcome to our regular listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, who's been giving us wonderful insights on various aspects of this great man's life, and of course, it's a program dedicated to his memory, and may God bless his great soul. And Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, salam and welcome to the program, first of all.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we're talking about economic pressure on Iran.
Yes.
And how the Imam, may God bless his great soul, yes, dealt with that.
Yes. How do you think he dealt with it?
I think he dealt with it beautifully by saying that, you know, we'll create a great wall around Iran and let us grow our own food. If that's the correct quotation.
He actually
quotation.
Said, if they wall us. If they put a big wall, it doesn't matter. Allah will send his rain, we will grow our own fruit.
Allah will send his rain and grow. I mean, this is wonderful. It comes right out of the Quranic text. I mean, he's taken me back to several very important stories in the Quran where, you know, Allah is the risk giver, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is where we as Muslims, you know, sometimes we wonder.
Are weak.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have enough trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And yet he is the one. There's a wonderful passage somewhere where Prophet Abraham says to his followers, I don't mean to digress, but we're basically talking. Yes. He says, he is the one who created me. When I was sick, he gave me health. When I was hungry, he fed me. You know, there's some verses like this, which I know I went through. And they're beautiful in terms of who it is that really raises you and who is the one who really sustains you. And of course, that's what we shouldn't lose sight of. And this is what the Imam points out over and over again, because he's his beloved. Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, loves Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
یه ملتی که شهادت را می طلبند و دعا می خواند برای شهادت اینها از دخالت نظامی می ترسند.
Does a nation that seeks martyrdom and even prays for martyrdom fear military intervention? Does it fear an economic blockade? If the whole world closes the doors of their countries to us, a country with a population of about 30 million, if they build a wall around Iran and imprison us here in Iran, we prefer it over having our doors open so that plunderers invade our country.
ما میخوایم چه بکنیم که به این تمدنی که از توخش بدتر است، این تمدنی که حیوانات بیابان.
What are we to do with this civilization which is worse than beasts? A civilization which the behavior of desert animals are better than it? Why would we ever need this civilization? This gate of civilization which the deposed Shah wanted to open to us means world powers should have full control over us and may take away all our possessions and then send us a couple of puppets. It means that they may take our oil and build a base for themselves. We need this great civilization for what? Is this civilization?
ما این تمدن بزرگ را می‌خوام چی بکنیم؟ این تمدن این پدر و پسر و خصوصا این پسر کشور ما را به عقب راند و همه چیز ما را به باد داد.
This father and son, and particularly this son, brought backwardness to our country and ruined everything, such that if even now all our nation joined their hands, as they have alhamdulillah done so, and intend to repair the damages that have been done to us in these 50 odd years, as well as the damages done to our country by America 20 odd years ago, it would take us many years to repair them.
ما میخوام چه کنیم روابط داشته باشیم با اونهایی که میخوان ما را بشاپن.
Why should we have ties with those who want to loot us? Is our relationship with them anything but that of a plunderer and one who is being plundered? Why should we need this? Let them close all the doors on us and impose an economic blockade on us. We ourselves have a vast country. We have water. Allah gives us rain. We ourselves will sow and eat from our own crops. We have no need of these issues. They must not try to frighten a nation which wants to give its life so that its independence is preserved. This independence and freedom that we have achieved is a heavenly gift. It is a divine gift which has come to us, and we are obliged to preserve it. If we do not preserve this, we have been ungrateful of Allah's blessing. We must preserve this blessing. We are not afraid of these threats that they make by bringing their naval vessels to the Persian Gulf and elsewhere and here and there. These are a thing of the past. Before, yes. In the past, it was such that when they wanted to impose a treaty, someone would let out a groan, and for example, a vessel would enter the Persian Gulf and the issue was settled.
خالی تمام میشه مثلا.
So Yeah, your take on that, please, Dr.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Well, you know, I think that quote that we heard, I mean, says it all. There's really not much more we can add to that.
Sure.
He's basically saying that, you know, they always threaten you with economic pressure, sanctions.
That's right, yes.
And he said, you know, a people who pray for martyrdom, who, you know, are connected to Allah, they don't, this stuff doesn't scare them.
It doesn't. No.
Military threats don't scare them, economic
sanctions don't scare them,
whatever. Yes. Mm. And unfortunately, this is the problem we have today, is that some Muslims, whether, you know, in generally in the Ummah, or whether it's in Iran, they don't really believe Allah's promises.
Mm.
They're not certain that Allah will help you.
Mm.
They say, yeah, okay, that's what it says in the Quran, and I believe it every now and then, and maybe, but maybe also we need to, you know, try to be good with Tawgut. And, you know, this is the beauty, when we talked about, you know, in a revolution and in this great movement, having a great leader like Imam and showing us the way, because obviously those people who have power and wealth, they will do anything to maintain their wealth and power.
Exactly.
And once they see things like military threats or coup d'etat attempts, or the invasion of Saddam, eight-year war, whatever, it doesn't reach its goal, they will go towards the economic side of things.
Sure.
And as the Supreme Leader has said so many times, their main focus today is economics.
Yes.
And this is why we have the resistance economy that was mentioned by the Supreme Leader, which is, it doesn't mean a sort of, you know, bare-bones economy. It means an economy that is able to resist these political pressures.
Exactly.
And this has to do with our internal capabilities and in our internal power.
Exactly.
If we are able to have a strong
self-reliant economy
domestically, then this will, you know, in many ways and as a multiplier, be able to resist those pressures that come from the outside.
Exactly.
And the bottom line is this, in the case of Iran. As long as the model for Iranian economy is selling oil to import stuff, whether that stuff is from Europe or America
or elsewhere,
or Russia or China or India or wherever, we're going to have problems.
Yes.
So we have to change that equation, which is, you know, sell the oil, the raw oil, the crude oil, for cash, and then use that cash to buy our stuff, which is basically what the, you know, the gentlemen in the south of the, in the Persian Gulf area do. This is their model of living.
True. Yes.
And believe me, it's more than just economics. It's a way of life.
Mm.
It's a lifestyle, as they say.
Yes.
And this is where you see, and this is connected to when you see the Supreme Leader talking about Islamic lifestyle and Islamic civilization. A Muslim and Islamic society has to be self-reliant, has to earn its income through work and through the power of its mind and the ability to innovate and to produce and to make things that are of benefit to humanity. And what we see with oil, unfortunately, oil is a good thing. I'm not against oil. Nobody's against oil.
No.
But what we see with oil as a reality of the matter is that you have the oil industry in Iran, which creates a lot of the income for the nation, and yet it's less than 2% of the population that's employed by it. It's in the nature of the thing. Okay, a nation that has mass employment and good jobs, you know, it's not going to happen just with the oil industry. Okay, assuming we have a doubling or tripling of this industry, if we're going to say that there is a concomitant amount of employment rise, which never happens, but let's just say theoretically, you would have 4% of the population in the oil industry. Well, you know, that's not enough.
No.
So we can't rely on the oil industry, and also we can't rely on crude oil. We have to process it.
Yeah, you have to diversify your economy.
Processing it means you're value adding. It means you're creating, you know, refineries, which are more jobs, which are more proper real jobs.
Jobs.
I say that as somebody, one of my grandfathers, his job was in the refinery.
Sure.
For 34 years. So I know what that means. And it was a proper job. It was a good job. It was well paying. It helped him support his family and, you know, whatever. A large family. It's a proper real industrial job. You remember those?
Sure.
You're an engineer?
Well, yes, we had them.
Remember?
Yes, and they're gone. Now we've got a service economy. which doesn't mean anything.
Right. Starbucks.
Starbucks. Latte. And, you know, propping up private banks, right, which take away your money anyway.
Right.
So.
Right. So poor
savings.
Exactly.
I'm bankrupt. And I make an appeal, actually, on this radio. That if there are any donations, please send them my way.
So, you see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So, in the best case...
Because of the austerity crisis.
Right.
Anyway,
in the best case, an oil industry, you turn it into an oil refining industry, or refining industry.
Yes, that's right. You've got to diversify.
So, which is petroleum products, everything from, you know... NAFTA.
Plastics to tarp, bitumen for roads, for example.
Exactly.
Asphalt,
all the things that, you know, everybody knows. Mm. Petrochemicals.
Sure.
And so on and so forth. Mm. You know, gasoline.
Yes.
Instead of, you know, importing gasoline, hey, why don't you export
it? Well, why don't you export it?
And the interesting thing is this. Let me just tell you a little story.
Please.
Which is that, you know, for all these years during the various governments, for whatever reasons, which we're not going to get into now, but by the tone of my voice, you can tell what
I
mean.
Yes, exactly. I know where you're going with
the
this.
The gentleman decided not to increase gasoline production in Iran. Mm. Very strange thing.
Yes.
One of the major oil exporters of the world, you know, top three, top four.
Four, and it's not exporting
gasoline. And it's not making gasoline.
Mm.
And it's importing all its gasoline. You remember those cries?
Yes.
You know, a couple of years back, we're going to, you know, sanction Iranian gasoline. We're going to shut down Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Remember?
Yes, I remember.
Do you recall this?
Yes.
Well, what did the government do within 6 months?
They produced more gasoline, didn't they?
Well, first, they rationed.
They rationed it.
Right.
So they could save it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one.
Number one.
Then what did they do? They started making gasoline.
Making gasoline, yes.
So within 6 months, they... A new oil minister comes in, Mr. Mir Kazemi, right? Former Revolutionary Guard.
Sure.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, you know they're going to sanction him, right?
Well, he's individually sanctioned, isn't he?
I don't know.
I don't.
The point I'm trying to make
is... Maybe he's not allowed to go to the toilet.
I don't know. The point is, within 6 months, we're...
Producing
We're not importing gasoline anymore.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Okay.
Mm.
So, whatever, the 30 years before?
Yes. You were importing it.
Right. 6 months?
6 months, you don't need to.
And nobody's talking about sanctioning Iran with gasoline anymore.
Yes.
I mean, I don't hear it. Have you
heard
it?
No, I've not heard
it recently.
Right?
No. Great example. Perfect example right there. Okay? So, what Imam is telling us, way back then. Remember?
Yes.
This is the beginning.
This is the beginning.
This is like,
there's nothing
you know,
there.
Like the first year of the revolution. This is not like some thing that he has come to the conclusion after 35 years. He's saying at that time, when our economy was completely dependent...
On the outside world.
As it had been for 100 plus years.
Yes, yes.
At that time, he's saying, who wants this kind of life and society?
Mm.
He says it's worse than animals to be dependent on these people.
Yes.
Okay? Mm. This is the beauty of Imam. Mm. Imam says things, he is the most clear about the matter, and he was the person that showed us the final...
End result.
The end result. Right there. From
right
the
there. From the beginning.
And it was all, as you mentioned, Quranic.
Mm-hmm.
It was all from the Quran.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm.
And why do we say this is important? Because explaining this is key.
Mm.
We claim
yes.
that the Quran is reality. The Quran is telling us
of
real cause and effect.
A real cause and effect, yes.
Okay?
Mm.
Quran is not like a story. It's not like some nice recitation.
Unfortunately...
Do you understand what I'm saying?
There's a point here.
It's a manual.
It's a manual. But the point is, this is the truth of the Quran itself. The Quran itself says that those who study this book or look at this book, for many, for the vast majority, it's a collection of stories. But for those of us who are given insight and wisdom into the book by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, they see lessons in this. They see reality in it, and this is the difference. Unfortunately, most Muslims are like this, that they just take the superficial end of the Quran and they just think that it's just a collection of stories.
Right.
And it doesn't have any relevance or any bearing on the reality of, you know, running a state, for example. Right?
Exactly. And the point is, and the Supreme Leader talks about this as well, and he puts it this way. He says, you either believe and rely on Nusrat-e-Ilahi,
yes.
The help of God,
yes.
On the support of God.
Sure.
Or you believe and rely on something else.
Exactly.
there's
no other way.
It's either this or that.
It's either this or that,
right?
Yeah.
Now, and the point is, look, for somebody who's not religious, who doesn't believe in God, whatever.
Mm.
All this stuff that we're saying doesn't have any relevance. We're talking to people who have in their heart and in their life are claiming and showing that they believe in God.
Mm.
Correct?
Correct.
This is what we're assuming.
Exactly.
That when you say that you believe in God, you really do. That, you know, when you pray and when you fast and when you're doing the things that you do, that you're doing this because you believe in God and God's power and God's presence in your life and all that. And then suddenly, when it comes to these pressures, suddenly you start doubting.
Mm.
This is what we're talking about. Okay? And again, I'm addressing myself first. I'm not claiming to be better than,
sure,
anyone.
Absolutely.
I'm simply saying that, do you really believe in God's promise? This is what you have to ask yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
This is what you have to ask yourself.
Mm. Do you really believe in God's promise?
Okay? This is the point. God says that he is, and the Supreme Leader again mentioned this. He said, there is ayah in the Quran. He says that it is incumbent on us. The victory of the moment is incumbent on us. If the moment follows what we say, and
exactly.
Allah saying it's incumbent on me.
It's incumbent on me to give you victory. He's
doing taklif for himself.
Taklif for himself.
It's wajib for me to give you.
Sure.
If you do these things, it's wajib for me.
Me.
SubhanAllah. Right?
Wonderful.
So why are you scared? Why are you worried if somebody, you know, threatens you with this or that?
That's where you get those wonderful metaphors in the Quran where God says, it wasn't you who threw the arrow, it was I. It wasn't you who threw the stone, it was I who threw the stone.
Exactly. So the point is simply that, you know, when Imam talks about these things, or when he talked about these things so many years ago, he hit the nail
on the head.
He you know, yes, it was bullseye.
I keep coming back to that head part again.
Right?
Yeah,
it's
right.
Bullseye.
It's a bullseye.
Right? Yeah. Way back then. None of this, you know, fancy schmancy economic stuff.
Yeah, homework stuff that we're all this analysis.
Right? The GDP, PPP, whatever, none of that
stuff.
Yeah,
doing on a power computer laptop to see exactly what it
is. Very clearly, Quranically said, listen, the country that is dependent on others is Zalil.
Is Zalil. It's enslavement.
Exactly. And We can't accept this. No. We would rather be walled in and not be disconnected from the rest of the world and grow our own food and eat it ourselves than to be part of this scheme. Again, what's the scheme? The scheme is you give us our oil, you give us your oil for cheap, we will give you whatever stuff you want. There is no dignity in this.
Exactly.
There is no dignity in this.
No.
There is no dignity in this. Don't be fooled by the expensive cars and the Burj Al Falah,
well,
you know.
This is
in Dubai and in Doha, you know, with the, you know, the branch of University of so-and-so and, you know, the branches of the Louvre. And this is all
nonsense.
It's all nonsense.
Because the point is this.
And okay.
I mean, I don't need to say this.
There's no dignity in this. You can't buy dignity.
Exactly.
From coffer.
Coffer.
You can't buy civilization from anyone.
I mean, the thing is that what I want to point out is that, you know, I don't mean to preach to somebody who's from, you know, from LSE, you know. This is the thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, you tell me. Because,
yes.
I mean, I am a layman as far as these things are concerned.
But you are an engineer.
Of course.
Yes.
But the thing is that, to me, it's all one-sided. That it's a one-way street.
Exactly. It's logic. I mean,
this is logical.
You don't have to
it's a one-way street. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to see this.
You don't have to be
But it's a one-way street. I mean, the moment the oil finishes or the gas finishes in, for example, UAE, that's the end of the story, isn't
it? It's only Abu Dhabi that has the oil.
Yeah, whatever.
You saw what happened to Dubai when the financial crisis happened.
It
all blew up.
And he went back and said,
cousin, give me a little cash.
A little bit.
He said, you know what, I'll give you the cash. Just change the name of the tower. It's no longer Burj Al Arab. It's Burj Al Khalifa.
Burj Al Khalifa.
Right?
My God.
Because
anyway,
I bailed you out.
Staggering economics. But anyway, carry on, sir. Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that when these resources are gone, and they're finite, they're limited, once they're gone...
It's about your dignity as a human being.
Being.
It's not about how much, you know, chickens you can stuff in your belly. Okay?
That's right.
Okay,
very nice.
It's called marginal utility. You know, after
marginal utility.
After the sixth chicken that you stuff in your belly, you don't really want anymore.
No,
right? There's a limit.
There's a limit to that. Of course there is.
You understand?
Absolutely.
And it goes down. The more you eat, the less it becomes. For most of us.
There are
some who can't eat enough, right?
They can't eat enough.
They can't get enough, right?
Yeah, that's a different story.
Okay?
Yes.
So,
unless you happen to be Abdul bin Aziz or something like that, in which all the chickens and sheep are consumed. Right.
Where there's a camel, in which there's a sheep. In which there's
a chicken as well.
And I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, you tell me. Right,
I haven't seen that. There's a
camel in which there's a goat in which there's a sheep. In which there's a
couple of stuffed chickens or something. Yeah. Well, sure,
that's how they eat.
Yeah,
that's how they eat.
Yeah.
You know, what can I say? Eat. I wouldn't even call that eating.
I wouldn't even call it that. Right. I mean, it has a whole new meaning to the Kalapachi or something. I don't know. I have no clue. Anyway. Carry on, sir, on this. But you're right, because we don't develop the infrastructure. We don't develop. I mean, the imam is not only talking.
It's not only the material thing. It's who you become as a human being. Being when you do
exactly
this.
In terms of the dignity of your mission.
It's about who you become as somebody who is using those blessings, those ni'mat. Mm. And he says it in the quote. I don't know if you know that we got to that part where he talks about, you know, you're doing kufr ni'mat.
Yes,
you're not dealing with you're not using the blessings that Allah has given you.
Exactly.
You know,
you're misusing them, actually.
Right. And so when that happens, guess what happens? Guess what Allah does then?
Mm.
What does He do? He takes away the blessings.
Of course He does, and He leaves you to yourself.
He says, "You I gave you the blessing. You you do it.
Go ahead.
You know better than me.
Okay. Go ahead.
Please.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Kay. We'll see how far you get.
It's up to you.
And then He reminds you very nicely. In many surahs in the Quran, how many a nation has destroyed itself by distancing itself.
I want to add a little example here of example. It's a little bit, you know, in parentheses. But I was reading recently a lot of rivayat. It said that if somebody goes after marrying a woman because of her money, then Allah will leave you to her and her money.
Very nice.
He says maybe I wanted to give you more money.
Huh? Maybe I wanted to give you more money. But no,
you didn't go after iman. You didn't go marry somebody because of their iman
or piety or whatever. Right.
You went for the money. So it's you and that money.
Well, it's very nice because, as you say, it's cause and effect. It's and the principle of the
and
thing.
And then there's another of it. Mm. It says you will always be zalim.
You'll not have any dignity or respect.
The money that your wife or her family has to give.
Exactly.
Okay. So it's very similar concept.
It is.
Okay. Mm. You want to be dependent on kufar? Go ahead. Be dependent on them.
Sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
See what you want to be dependent on me.
Exactly.
Now, this is again. Mm-hmm. If somebody is not religious, somebody doesn't care about God, doesn't even believe in God, whatever. We're not even dealing with you because you don't get it. What we're talking about, right?
Exactly.
We're talking to people who claim who say we believe in God.
God.
Well, this is where it shows itself. This is where it shows itself. Mm.
So how about a little faith?
Right. And not all this crazy talk about, you know, if we just do this, if we just do that, if they just smile at us, if we just wink at them, you know, if we just, you know, rub a little elbows, and if we just, you know, deal with this, or if you give us a little bit of that, we'll give you a little bit of this. I'm not questioning normal interstate affairs. Normal international relations between two states and two governments. This is normal affairs. You talk to everyone, you know, you...
No, that's an entire... Diplomacy is an entirely different
Diplomacy
field.
Is diplomacy. It has its place.
It has its
always,
place.
It's always there. Mm. The point is not to rely... As a Muslim. Don't rely on kafir. Don't rely on your rizq coming from, you know, appeasing the kafir.
Well, the point is this, my friend. The thing is that when we look at the life of the... This is why the life of the Prophet... We have to go back to that. When we look at the life of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. Did he do that? I mean, all the kafirs of his time were saying to him, look...
We'll give you everything.
We'll give you whatever you want. The most beautiful woman, we'll give you that. You want power and position, we'll give you that. You want to be chief of everything, we'll give you that. We'll give you Makkah even. We'll give you the whole lot.
We'll give you all the money.
But just stop saying what you're saying. Just stop what you're doing. Okay? And what did he say? Put the sun in my right hand, put the moon in my left hand. Yeah?
I can't stop.
Need I say anymore?
Right. Now, this is the point. Mm. We have these examples. All of us, those who claim to be Muslims, know these stories.
We do.
We've read the Quran. We've read the Rivayat, whether it's Shia or Sunni.
Yes, these are...
Okay? Yeah. We've read them all.
Yeah.
Do we really believe it?
Well,
this is the thing.
Do we really act on it in our own
lives?
When the rubber hits the road?
When I the like going that. Gets rubber tough? Hits the road, yeah.
When the going gets tough?
When the going gets tough?
You know, yeah. I'm not going to use other expressions.
Please don't, because right? you, other images start coming to mind.
So the point is that
yeah.
when Imam is talking about this, way back then, okay, he's giving us a principle. He's giving us this a highway. He's giving us
the road. Showing us the road.
A basic fundamental thing, which is, you know, it's better to be self-reliant and to, you know, have to work a little harder and to maybe have some of the things that you really think are really neat and cool.
Unnecessary, yeah.
And, I really want that iPad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, maybe you won't get the latest model.
Sure.
Okay, but by the way, can I just say that anything you want in this world, you can find in Iran. Okay, just giving this as a news.
Yeah, as a news.
Okay, yes, sanctions has no effect.
I've seen that in Tehran.
Right?
I've seen that in Tehran.
Anything that's produced anywhere in the world,
you will find it in Tehran.
You know, two days later, it's in Tehran.
In 2 days,
at a reduced price. Okay?
Yes.
At a reduced price of what it's sold in the actual market.
Yeah, of course it is. It's cheaper.
And you understand, right?
I understand it because I've seen that. I've physically seen
it. You know, this is not something that's really...
No, you're not making that up.
Right. No. So... I don't know what it is that people are so crazy about. I think it goes back to one thing, which we've talked about many times before, which is that the main way in which Western powers have tried to dominate the Islamic world is through nurturing their own elites in Muslim worlds.
Exactly.
And how do they do that? They do that by making them the representatives of their business affairs in the home country, so that they can get percentages and that they can get the money from selling the Western goods in those countries. And this is how they run the affairs of things, and it's no different in Iran today as it was 40 years ago.
Well, on that note, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, thank you for that, but we need to review our path on Sirat al-Mustaqim, honestly.
Especially if you say that you follow Imam Khomeini.
Thank you very much indeed for that, sir. And I just say to our listeners, I hope you benefited from the program. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and Muslim blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Islamic Revolution and New Islamic Civilization. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The statement of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, which was issued by the leader on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the revolution, was indeed the upper hand document of establishing the new Islamic civilization. Among the oppressed nations, few stage a revolution. And among those which do so, few have managed to finish the job. In other words, among those few nations which have changed the ruling system, very few have successfully kept the ideals of revolution in the face of hostilities and plots. But the Islamic revolution of the Iranian nation was an exception in this regard. It has been the most popular revolution of not the 20th century, but several centuries. Therefore, it has boastfully insisted on its ideals despite 43 years of ceaseless hostility and conspiracy of enemies. The The Islamic Revolution terminated the long history of decadence. Iran had been humiliated during various kingdoms, particularly the Qajarid and Pahlavi rules. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the backwardness of Iran during the Pahlavi regime, "Before the rule of Islam in this country, we were a backward nation in the full sense of it. We were dependent, politically backward, scientifically backward, socially backward, and isolated in the world of politics. Today, the progresses of the Islamic Republic have urged even our enemies to admit. Today, in the scientific ranking, in the technological ranking, in many modern sciences of the world, we are at the grade of advanced countries. The Islamic Ummah, with a strenuous and serious effort, can design the Islamic civilization of this era, to set its foundations, to make it flourish and put it forward before the eyes of mankind." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, introducing the Islamic civilization, says, "In the new Islamic civilization, spirituality stands beside material issues and ethics. Spirituality is beside the progress of material life." Ayatollah Khamenei further explains that the new Islamic civilization consists of two parts, namely, instrumental and real. The instrumental part includes the values that we consider as progress, such as sciences, inventions, industry, politics, economy, political and military might, international position, etc. The real part of the civilization consists of lifestyle and whatever shapes our life, like family, way of marriage, kind of house, type of clothing, consumption pattern, kinds of food, cuisine, entertainment, job and employment, way of conduct at work, behavior in university, school and the media, behavior with friends, enemies and foreigners. According to the Quran, material and spiritual growth will come to existence once the society and individuals move in the way of God. In view of this, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, introduced monotheism as the core of his mission. The knowing of prophethood, which comes after monotheism, also means knowing the Islamic unity and civilization. The Prophet founded the Islamic unity and civilization and fulfilled many social, cultural, political, and economic changes to set the ground for establishment of a glorious global civilization in a short period. Thus, the monotheistic Ummah and the Islamic civilization thereof are based on the rule of Allah. Ayatollah Khamenei, stressing this issue, maintains that the society based on monotheism will achieve all beliefs which the Islamic civilization brings about. According to verse 257 of chapter Baqara of the Quran, "Allah is the guardian of the faithful. He brings them out of darkness into light." Thus, the reality of the Islamic civilization is to get distant from darkness and entering light. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "The world of Islam today is duty-bound to breathe the spirit in this world, like Islam itself and the Prophet himself, to create a new atmosphere, to open a new way. We call this phenomenon, which we are waiting for, as the new Islamic civilization. We should pursue the new Islamic civilization for mankind. This basically differs from what the powers are thinking and doing for mankind. It does not mean capturing lands. It does not mean transgressing upon the rights of nations. It does not mean imposing one's ethics and culture on other nations. It means to present the divine gift to nations so that nations, through their free will, through their choice, and through their distinguishing, choose the right way. The way towards which today the world powers have taken nations is a wrong and a straight way. This is our duty today. Dear friends, the victory of the Islamic Revolution and emergence of the Islamic Iran as a powerful country challenging the very existence of big powers has made it possible to found a new Islamic civilization. Ayatollah Khamenei says unity is not a political and tactical move. It is rather a heartfelt belief and faith in the necessity of the unity of the Islamic Ummah. The first step in the unity of the Islamic Ummah is for the Muslim communities, governments, ethnicities, and denominations to refrain from aggressing on and striking one another to get united against the common enemy. And in the next steps, the Islamic countries should have synergy and make effort together in sciences, riches, security, and political power in order to reach the new Islamic civilization. The Islamic Revolution is marking its 43rd anniversary. Although the enemies of this revolution have incessantly schemed innumerable plots since the birth of this revolution to destroy it, it has stood tall in the world and kept inspiring new generations to withstand big powers with the hope in a bright future in which there would be no place for the global arrogance symbolized in the US and the fabricated Zionist regime of Israel.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. The event of January 9th was an example. The event of January 9th in the year 1978 was the same. At that time too, there was a big threat that lasted several months, but the people's zeal brought them into the arena on the 9th of January and put an end to the threat and any ill effects it may have had. Their zeal turned that threat into an opportunity. So one point is that the religious zeal of the people had been the main factor in these achievements and in turning threats into opportunities. This should be preserved. Speakers, writers, and those who can influence the people's thinking should pay attention to this point. Of course, it is evident that the opponents and enemies will be busy in this regard. They will question the statements that I have made today, but the truth is this. The truth is that religious zeal should be preserved in the people, and by God's grace it will be preserved.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second point I wish to raise is that you must pay attention to the fact that one of the things that is very serious in the plots formulated by the enemies of the religious and Islamic Republic is their plan to eliminate sensitivity about the principles and foundations of the revolution. The people are sensitive about the fundamental principles of the revolution, and they refute those who question these principles. However, the enemies wish to gradually undermine this sensitivity. They are attempting to do this using the vast propaganda that is being spread through the internet and in the foreign media in one way or another. Sometimes they highlight and magnify the viewpoints of people who are not of much value, neither their comments nor their ideas. There are some people who have a limited intellectual capacity, and they make extravagant claims and question the principles and foundations of the revolution. One important principle of the revolution is the authority of religion. The Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution was essentially established for the sake of the authority of God's religion. They were established to help society have a religious form and a religious geometry. They were established to help the government take on a religious geometry and to move forward accordingly. This was one of the clear principles of the revolution. The people laid down their lives and offered their blood for this to come about. This authority of religion is one of the principles of the religion, but they are undermining this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Gave me hope, oh Allah, I wanna thank.
about today.
Several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated or actually dumped by major Western powers because the vaccines expired within weeks of being received as donations. Last December, Nigeria had no option but to destroy more than 1 million doses of expired AstraZeneca vaccines. A senior official speaks here on the expired vaccines. Let's take a listen.
In an environment where, despite the interest, despite concerted effort by the federal government to procure these vaccines were not available in the open market a few months ago because they had largely been mopped up by the wealthier nations.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and as always, it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are focusing on how Western countries stockpile excess vaccines and donate them to African countries when they are about to expire. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about Djibouti, a tiny but strategic Horn of Africa state that has been turned into a hub of imperialist powers seeking to spread the hegemony all over Africa and beyond. Stay with us until the end of our show.
Expired COVID-19 vaccines in Africa. Several African countries, including Nigeria, Uganda, and Malawi, have been forced to destroy millions of doses of expired COVID-19 vaccines that were donated by Western countries. This scandal comes at a time when many countries on the African continent are facing vaccine nationalism and apartheid from the West.
In response to this dumping of expired vaccines, Dr. John Nkenga Song, director of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recently called for donated COVID-19 vaccines to come with a shelf life of 3 to 6 months. He says this will enable countries plan their rollouts and avoid a situation where doses expire. He noted that African countries are now refusing donated vaccines that are about to expire.
Certain countries are actually refusing totally to accept the vaccines because of exactly that. If they see that the shelf life that of the given vaccine is only 1 month or 2 months, they prefer not to receive those vaccines because it will create a narrative that vaccines have expired in their countries. I think most countries are very sensitive to that now.
Now, to discuss this dumping of vaccines in Africa by Western countries, we contacted Dr. Catherine Chabutungi, an epidemiologist and the executive director of African Population and Health Research Center. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated by major Western powers because they expired within weeks of being received as donations. Now, what's your take on this?
The African systems for delivering the COVID vaccine have not evolved, in the last 12 months, if I could say, from early 2021. The systems have not evolved because supply has been erratic, it has been unpredictable, and so it is inevitable that when you have millions of doses being dumped on the continent in the last 2 months of the year, that it is inevitable that those doses cannot be absorbed in the time frame they're supposed to be absorbed in. If these were doses which perhaps are going to expire after 7 months or after 9 months, that wouldn't be a problem. But dumping millions of doses on a system which has not been set up to absorb those doses at the time of the year when there's so much disruption because of the Christmas break, I think it was inevitable. That's what I would say, and that's what I said, that it was inevitable. And it's such a shame that we are in a situation where few doses of vaccines are being wasted just because of the way the whole global supply system is set up.
This dumping of about to expire vaccines is regrettable, especially as Africa remains the least vaccinated continent against COVID-19. The move to dump vaccines in Africa